Namaste and welcome to the Bharat Varta podcast. I'm Roshan Karyapa. These last couple of years, the world has been gripped by the pandemic. Looking back, how has India managed to fare during these very tough times? That's the subject of the book, A Nation to Protect, Leading India Through the COVID Crisis. We have the author, Priyam Gandhi Modi. Priyam ji is a strategist specializing in political communication. She frequently writes political nonfiction, and this is her third book. She's a proud alumna of the University of Delaware and Florida State University. And in this podcast, we'll be covering various aspects of the book and, of course, how the Indian government agencies handle the COVID crisis. So thank you so much for joining us on Bharat Varta, Priyam ji. Delighted to have you.
Thank you, Roshan. Thank you for having me.
It's such a wonderful book, as I was saying, and I think it's so important to record contemporary history because we forget so easily. And a lot has happened, more than anybody would be able to fathom over the last couple of years or so. So let me begin by first asking you, why did you decide to write the book? What was the inspiration and how did you put it together? What was the experience like?
So exactly this, you know, on the lines that you were saying, that when events were playing out, especially during the second wave, you know, even during the first wave, the migrants crisis and everything, the way we managed to flatten the curve after the first, the first wave, then how the second wave sort of unfolded and the whole oxygen issue. So the way the events were, you know, unfolding, I was really noticing that the media, the general mainstream media, is very like oriented to, you know, the sensation of the news cycle, you know, that what works and what brings the TRP and all of that. And that I felt that, you know, they left out so many details. You know, it's not magically that the country was able to respond the way it did. It's because, you know, there was meticulous planning and, you know, lacks of hands behind this. So this needed to be recorded since, you know, the mainstream media wasn't doing it. And that's why I decided to write the book.
Yeah, I mean, we'll delve into a little bit of the media narratives and the stories a little further in the conversation. But I think it's a great service that you've written this book so people can see a factual reporting of what really happened. One of the things that India really got right was our very serious and early response. You know, what did we do right? What do you think we did right? I know you talk about it in detail in the book, but if you could talk us through, you know, maybe the first few days and weeks of the pandemic that really perhaps saved us from a lot of destruction.
Sure. You know, this is in the book, but I'm still going to say it here, that when the virus from China, it had spread to the UAE, it had spread to Europe, parts of Europe, it had spread to the United States. Everybody thought that India was the next hotspot. And if the virus comes here, that's it. That's doomsday for the country. That's doomsday for the world. Now, around the same time, the prime minister, he was hearing from his, you know, personal network of people about the severity of the virus, you know, the ground reports coming in, what China wasn't letting out, our intelligence reports were coming in. And this is all in January and February 2020. At that point, he spoke with the secretary and he said, this is a situation where it is better to be over prepared than under. Let's put together a team and let's figure out how we're going to deal with the virus when it comes to our doorstep. Not if it comes, but when it comes to our doorstep. That's how, you know, the immediate team was put in place in, you know, early 2020. So January and February of 2020, our principal science advisor and Dr. V.K. Paul of NITI Aayog, they started, you know, having multiple one-on-one sessions at NITI Aayog to figure out the nature and the character of the virus that was coming out, what the scientist community was saying and how other countries were responding. So this was all pre-March 2020.
Yeah, and it was remarkable foresight, right? I mean, because I think the SARS-CoV virus before, I mean, hadn't really, you know, affected us greatly. And even at that point, I think maybe December, Jan, even the WHO and, you know, other agencies were not really pushing the alarm as such, right? I mean, they're not pushing the panic button yet.
Weren't. Yeah. And in fact, WHO maintained until March 2020 that there is no human to human transmission. Yeah. It was only when Dr. Paul and the principal scientific advisor, Mr. Vijay Raghavan, they were looking at the doubling rate of the virus, and they're like, if there is no human to human transmission, this doubling rate is way too high. So there has to be human to human transmission for such a high doubling rate. And that's how, you know, we started depending on our own indigenous expertise versus listening to what was coming in from outside the country.
And that perhaps saved us a great deal.
Absolutely.
So one of the things that strikes me throughout the book is how different, very different people and very different agencies with very different skill sets all come together in some, one very coordinated fashion to work on specific problems. You mentioned a couple of names as well, and there are many, many more, you know, nameless, faceless people who really helped us through the last couple of years, right? Could you give us a sense of, you know, what were the teams involved and how they kind of came together?
Yeah. So, you know, so there is a story, there's a backstory in this as well. So when the Prime Minister took office in 2014, you know, it's no secret that our bureaucracy likes to work very singularly, you know, very individually. And this is something, you know, that really bothered him. Since he took office in 2014, you know, he's been putting together teams of very senior bureaucrats across ministries and across departments. He would give them like a common task. He would ask them to come together and find solutions for that common task. You know, and he would do things like he would send some bureaucrats to, you know, the hometown where they first started their service. You know, and then they like tell them to introspect that is this how you started out? You know, where is your energy? You know, why don't you try to, you know, problem solve more practically? So by the time the pandemic hit us, 2020, the bureaucrats kind of knew how the Prime Minister likes to work. So they knew that they needed to come together. It had to be a whole of government approach for this problem to be solved. This is number one. Number two, there was a very high level meeting which the principal secretary had chaired, and he had asked a bunch of questions that how long is it going to take us to, you know, increase the testing labs and, you know, a bunch of questions like that. And then, you know, he kind of saw that if departments work singularly, you know, it's going to be, the progress is going to be much slower. And, you know, then the problem is just going to snowball into something that all of us cannot control, you know. So this is a feedback that he also gave to the Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister was very clear that, you know, it has to be a whole of government approach. Not one department is going to be accountable. Everybody is going to be accountable. So they formed empowered teams. They formed 11 empowered teams. And these empowered teams would have senior bureaucrats and private experts and researchers from across the board. And everybody would sit together and problem solve. And these empowered teams would report directly to the PM. So they were given that decision-making authority, which is usually slow in the bureaucracy. So that's, you know, so that's how everybody sort of came together and, you know, was able to work on this together.
Yeah, it's a fantastic lesson in organization design itself. I mean, given the complexity of the problem, how everything sort of came together. One of the first things that we had to do in response was ramp up our capacity, right? And of course, I mean, we're famously short of everything, perhaps given the scale of India. We had to ramp up on testing, on PPE kits, and so on and so forth. Can you take us through, you know, what was the difference in numbers and how quickly we kind of made up for the deficits?
Right. So in March 2020, we barely had any PPE kits, you know, even masks, like, you know, a few lakhs, you know, which was absolutely not enough for all of us, you know, not even for our healthcare workers. PPE kits, we didn't even have, you know, like the manufacturing baselines, you know, to manufacture them here. So we were absolutely, you know, under-equipped. Even for ventilators, we were importing all of our ventilators. We only had about 16,000 ventilators in our public hospitals, which was not going to be enough at all, because by then, Dr. Paul and, you know, our principal scientific advisors knew that this is a respiratory problem. So in case of escalation of disease, ventilator is going to be an absolutely crucial tool. So we're going to need a lot more of those. So then they started to, you know, for PPE kits and for masks, you know, the Department of Textiles, you know, and the industry came together, and, you know, they very, very quickly put in place, you know, guidelines and, you know, baselines on which, you know, how they have to be manufactured. Private sector came together so quickly and helped government so, you know, so well that by July, we were not only were we self-sufficient, but we were exporting them as well to other countries. And ventilators also, you know, we were able to, you know, ramp up capacities very quickly. We were able to replace parts which are difficult to get with, you know, 3D printing. So we really, you know, were innovative, you know, to and we innovated and, you know, found solutions.
And then we had the Janta curfew, of course. And on 24th March, we announced the first lockdown for 21 days. I don't think anybody could have believed that a nation of almost 1.4 billion people would stay indoors. You know, we've seen, in fact, how people in, more developed nations have kind of responded to some of these clampdowns, lockdowns, and so on, right? So why was this necessary to go into a full lockdown and not do maybe what some of the other countries were doing, right? I mean, so something with slight relaxations and so on. Why was the full lockdown necessary, and what was the impact of the lockdown?
Right. So at that point, I'll tell you why we needed to go under a full lockdown. So some of the countries were trying to have like a sort of a mixed response, you know, where they would let, economic activities go on, but everything else would be shut. But then we were seeing, we were also lucky that the virus hit us almost a month later than it hit many other parts. So we were able to observe. So we were seeing that even in this mixed response, you know, there came a point where the virus and the transmission got so out of hand that they had to go under immediate lockdown. So very senior doctors, for example, Dr. Devi Shetty, they recommended that better to be preemptive and, go under total lockdown now versus panicking and going under an unplanned lockdown when the transmission goes too, gets too much to control, when we run out of hospital space, when we, when we don't have enough doctors for the, for our patients. So instead of that situation arising, it's better to just be preemptive about it and flatten the curve, augment our capacities first, get ready to handle that surge of cases that's coming our way in urban, rural, and semi-rural, areas. And which is why we went under total lockdown. Now, why the country followed it is because of our prime minister. Everybody was very, very scared. We were seeing the reports coming in from Italy. We were seeing, coffins kind of like stacked up and taken to, burial grounds, in ambulances. Everybody was very, very afraid, and we all needed to trust somebody. We needed that strong leadership. The Janta curfew was like a litmus test. When the country rallied behind the Janta curfew, he knew that the people were looking to him for advice, were looking to him for leadership, and he knew that he had to communicate directly to the people and he was going to be accountable. So that's what, sort of worked. And that's why I think 1.3 billion people stayed at home.
And there was a period of lull up until maybe around February of 2021. And then perhaps we had the worst period for a month and a half, maybe 2 months. Which was the brutal second wave that we experienced, right? What were some of the reasons? There were, reasons saying that, there was election campaigning and there was, travel and so on and so forth, right? Some people saying that, we were too lax and we were complacent and so on and so forth. What was the reasons for the second wave? And do you think we could have done something better during that time?
Prashant, my opinion, and this is what I put in the book and it's supported with data, that when the farmers' protest started in November 2020, farmers' protests had rolling crowd. Okay, people were coming in, people were going out. They were bringing the virus with them. There was very little testing going on at the protest sites. And also to remember, the alpha variant had begun to circulate as well. So we had the original virus and we had the alpha variant and we had the protesters, which were, a rolling crowd. Now, when you look at the data, you will see that the decline of our first wave, that decline stopped in Haryana, Punjab, Delhi, these states first in January 2021. Okay, that's when the decline stops. And maybe a couple of weeks after that, you start seeing the rise in the wave again in those states, in Haryana, Punjab, Delhi first. Okay, then we see what happened in Maharashtra, where the variant sort of mutated and became like the Delta variant. Now, this is true even today for any new variant that comes in. We don't know how transmissible it is, and we don't know the effect that that variant is going to have on the population till the time it starts spreading in the population. By then, it is too late to control it, right? So that's kind of what happened with the second wave. It was already too late. The Delta had already spread. I think the second wave started with the farmers' protests. And then, people were just so, I think pandemic fatigue, that they wanted to go about their lives. You know, they were desperate to start living their, you know, pre-pandemic life again. You know, the elections. Okay, now let's talk about the elections for a moment here. In Bihar, the election commission held an all-party meeting and suggested that, you know, hey, why don't you do virtual rallies since we're in the middle of a pandemic. By then, our home minister, Mr. Amit Shah, had already done, you know, a round of virtual rallies in Bihar, and, you know, they had kind of observed that there was deep penetration and all of that. But it's the opposition parties, including the Congress and Tejasvi Yadav, who said we just cannot penetrate, and this is going to be a disadvantage for us if you're going to just do virtual rallies. So they just outright rejected that. Now look at it, you know, look at the elections of March 2021. Since the virtual rally route was out, there were physical campaigns. All parties were campaigning. It's not like any one party decided to sit out. All of them were campaigning. People were going about their lives. People were living about their life, you know, wanted to live, you know, how they lived in the pre-pandemic.
And the spikes happened in states like Kerala and Maharashtra, right? I mean, that's the... those had the highest caseloads where there weren't no elections, actually. I mean, the elections were in TN and West Bengal, if I remember correctly, and Bihar, of course. The real cases happened there. On that note, you know, one of the things that I think people generally tend to underestimate is the amount of cooperation you require from the states, right? I mean, India is still very federal in that structure. You know, what were some of the, you know, in your study of the entire, like, couple of years, who were some of the most forward-thinking states, and what were some of the states that kind of held the government down, weighed them down, and so on and so forth?
So I think, you have to see that Maharashtra, for instance, they started their oxygen audits only when the second wave had already begun to spread in the state. Now, there are two ways that the state responded. There was one way that the bureaucracy of the state responded, and then there was one way that the politicians of the state responded. Now, Maharashtra, for instance, you'll see that around March, mid-March, or I think mid-April was, that there was a night where we were going to run out of oxygen in some of our major hospitals, and the patients had to be shifted to a jumbo COVID center. Now, after that, the next day, the campaigning for the elections was going on at that point. So our chief minister's office put out a media message that said that, okay, the chief minister tried to call up the prime minister, but the prime minister is really busy campaigning and we're going to run out of oxygen. At the same time, the MCGM chief, Mr. Iqbal Chahal, he came out to say that, you know, I immediately spoke to, you know, the principal secretary the next morning at, say, at 7 a.m., called me back within 2 minutes. We arranged for better logistics of oxygen. We didn't, you know, we proposed that, okay, let us get oxygen from Gujarat via, you know, the other parts of the country where it was coming from, where it was taking longer to come. And, you know, they immediately found a solution to that within a couple of hours, and, you know, it was good to go. So again, the bureaucracy responded very differently and the politicians responded very differently. And we saw that in, you know, the opposition states, especially even Delhi, you know, during the entire oxygen management. They were not, you know, despite having an entire system of how they had to raise oxygen demands with the center, they were not raising those demands with the center. They were raising the demands for oxygen in court.
Yeah, no, and at a time when, you know, people of, you know, all parties had to come together, I think they were, you know, competitively bad, I would say, right? I mean, every party had its own thing. You mentioned Delhi. I mean, there was also the case of Akhilesh Yadav, who said the vaccines, I won't use the vaccine or something like that, right? And there were plenty of instances of this one-upmanship that really, you know, made things more complicated. What were a couple of other incidents that you remember in terms of...
Right. So this vaccine, so to discredit our vaccine was a full-blown conspiracy. So let me give you examples, you know, which prove that. Yes, Mr. Akhilesh Yadav said that I'm not going to take this BJP vaccine. I don't trust them. Once my government comes in power, we will make our own vaccine. We'll make our own vaccine and we'll vaccinate our people. Okay, that's number one. Now, Dr. Shamika Ravi, Vice President of Observer Research Foundation, she's done a study that says that the strongholds, the Samaj Party strongholds in UP, they saw very less vaccine uptake, significantly lesser than other parts of the state, until Mr. Yadav and his father publicly took the vaccine. So that's now that is one example. But they still don't learn, right? Like when he started campaigning again this year, he again said that I've not taken the second dose of the vaccine. Never mind. Now let's look at some other examples. When when emergency authorization was given to Covishield and Covaxin, or in the first week of January, Mr. Anand Sharma and Mr. Shashi Tharoor, both of them, one asked that why are we not asking the United Kingdom to give us more data on AstraZeneca? Why would we need to ask the United Kingdom for data on AstraZeneca? We had bridge trials that went on over here that showed great, positive results. There was no reason for us to ask the United Kingdom for anything. And the other said that, the trials for Covaxin are not complete. And, why are you rushing into this? So there was a whole effort to discredit both our vaccines, not just one. Both our vaccines. Had that caught steam, we would have seen a lot of vaccine hesitancy and anti-vax movements here also that we see in many other parts of the world.
And the political parties were not alone, right, in this. Again, it was further complicated by some of the media narratives and stories as well, which you mentioned earlier on. Whether it's the stories on the migrant crisis or the shortages of supplies and reporting on deaths and so on, both the local and the international media just simply piled on at a time when, they really had to be more responsible. You talk about a couple of instances of a few anchors, really going, too far. Could you give us those instances as well?
Okay, now let's consider that we're in the middle of a global pandemic. Every country, every human life is being impacted by this pandemic, okay? Number two, in the middle of a wave of a pandemic, if you're going to set out in your Ertiga and go to different parts of the country and, film whatever is happening, you're obviously not going to see happy families living together. You're in the middle of a very severe wave of a global pandemic. So that's not going to happen. So you are going to find a change in lifestyle amongst the population than you would find in a non-pandemic year. That is common sense. But having said that, many other countries, like we discussed, we've seen visuals, in the early part of the pandemic, of coffins being stuffed in ambulances and, taken to graveyards and all of that. But what we saw here, the kind of vulturism that we saw here, where they sit right outside, like the, the crematoriums, they film bodies being burnt, especially the Hindu pyres being burnt and all of that. It was really, distasteful. And, and also, one of the things is that these people never really went around to say, burial grounds of, where Muslims are buried or any other religions, So is it that only Hindu people died? That's not true. There was a certain narrative that was crafted, to discredit India. At the same time, they were showing these very creatively captured videos of the Kumbh Mela, the images and videos of the Kumbh Mela. Now, it's important to remember that the Kumbh Mela sees footfalls of, 5-6 crore people at, on the days of the Snan. In this year, in this pandemic year, they only saw about 9 or 10 lakh people. And that too, it was, mostly the devotees and the, our saints and seers who come out, who come down only for, this out of their, meditation. So how could you have stopped something like that? At the same time, just barely a few weeks after that, Punjab celebrated Halla Mohalla, the Congress government in Punjab. When the bureaucrats said, why don't you follow COVID protocol? They said, no, we don't follow any COVID protocol. They still went ahead with the festival. Then in UP, a Muslim cleric died. There were thousands and thousands of people who attended the funeral when only 20 people were allowed to attend it. But the media didn't cover that either, So, I feel that there was, they wanted to take that narrative in a certain direction. And several parts of the media sort of conspired to make that happen. Like if you look at, I'll answer this. This is my last point, this question. So Washington Post ran a front page story, which said that the second wave is so bad in India that Indians are burning bodies on the street. You and I are Indians. Have you seen any burning bodies on the street? No. So I'll tell you why this is coming from. The same story was lifted from the Straits Times, and who also reported this. You know why they reported this? Because the Chief Minister of Karnataka announced a policy saying that because we don't want crowding at the funeral, at the crematorium, we will allow burning of bodies in large open ground. So just on that statement, they, you know, they sort of assumed that Indians were allowed to burn bodies on streets, which is not true.
No, complete madness. But I think throughout the crisis, all of this was countered by the government's communication, right? It's been totally on point, I would say. Whether it was the Prime Minister's speeches or the caller tunes advising people on COVID sensitive protocols, and both the tone and the articulation was really amazing. What was the thinking behind all of this, and how did it happen so seamlessly?
So I'll give you an example. When the Prime Minister, reads a lot of, you know, he was reading a lot of scientific papers that were coming in, okay, before taking any major decisions. Now, so at that point, he was reading that the virus is most likely spreading through aerosols. And now, since it's spreading through aerosols, it's even cloth masks are quite effective in containing the spread, okay, in containing the human to human spread. So, which is why in April, when he came on TV with that, you know, muffler, and he put it down, and then, you know, he said that everybody must wear a mask. If not an N95, you must wear a cloth mask. And he kept that as his display picture on his social media until the time we reached 1 billion vaccine doses, indicate how important and how crucial mask wearing was. So his messages have been very consistent. He's not been, you know, he didn't flip-flop that ye nahi karna hai, okay, what I announced 1 week back, forget about it, let's do something else, which we saw a lot of major world leaders do.
Yeah, the impact of the economy was severe, right? I mean, because the lockdowns and almost, you know, all the business activity coming to a standstill. This was also a time when the Prime Minister announced the Atmanirbhar Bharat initiative in May of 2020, which was a positive message in the face of a crisis. Again, you know, what was the thinking behind that? And what was the plan to get the economy back on revival again?
Right. So now, you know, I've explained some of this in the book, but think of it as a dumbbell. Okay. So there are two ends, which are major events, and then it's connected with a line, right? We adopted a modified barbell strategy. Now, what that means, a complete lockdown, complete shutdown of economic activity is a major event. So think of it as one side of that bar. Now, several countries, even at that point, when we announced our first relief measures, said, why is it so small? You know, you should be going all out. You should be putting cash in the hands of all Indians, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Many people had many opinions. However, what we wanted to do is we wanted to see how the economy is, you know, slowly picking up, and we wanted to put our money where we would have a multifold impact and a compounding impact. So as we got feedback on the ground, we had these like phases in which we announced our relief measures. So we announced each phase based on the feedback that we were getting on ground. And that worked so well. By November 2020, we were on our way to like a full economic recovery. You know, that's because we didn't spend all of our money at once, and we spent it in areas which needed. So we needed to spend it in employing people who had gone back to the migrants who had gone back to the village. Now, which is why a huge 300% increase in infrastructure spend that helped them, because all of them got those jobs, right? So it sort of like compounded that, our response. So it's that modified bubble response that we adopted.
Yeah, by I think around October of 2020 itself, the export numbers, the GST collections, BMI index, all of those metrics and numbers started showing very positive signs. Right?
Yes.
One of the other facets of the economy was, you know, how well we did the targeted welfare, right? Which was, again, you know, I mean, given the length and breadth of India, it's definitely not a trivial thing, right? A very, very complex challenge. Could you talk to us about that specifically?
Sure. Even this is pre-Janta curfew, when there was a meeting in the PMO, the Prime Minister was sure that we have to put food on the table for our most vulnerable people. And our very, very vulnerable people are over 80 crore people. So he said, nobody should go hungry. And that has to be our foremost priority if we're going to shut down the economy and wait for it to come back, you know, to pre-pandemic level. So having, so that's how the food, the free food, the 5 kg, you know, food that we offer, the wheat rice pulses program that we offer, that came into being. Now, the other important thing that worked for us is the direct benefit transfer. Now, many countries struggled with actually you know, making the money reach the beneficiary in a very short period of time. In the United States, for example, the governor said that, right, you know, to the central government that you give us the money and then we'll pass it on, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there were several issues in several different countries. But because we have the direct benefit transfer set in place long before the pandemic hit us, we were able to send the money to the target groups very, very quickly, you know, in a record period of time.
And perhaps the biggest success story in all of this was the phenomenal vaccination drive, right? And
of course.
Yeah, so we were tracking it almost on a weekly basis on Bharat Varta, and it was really heartening because I think for all of our lives, we've heard India is so famously short of state capacity. And here was the Indian government delivering vaccination to, you know, the length and breadth of the country again, almost 1 billion people vaccinated. How did this happen? Again, you know, plenty of different agencies coming together, but how did this happen?
So let me first start by saying that this kind of risk funding that the Indian government has done to vaccine manufacturers, this has never been done in any other industry before. Okay. So from April 2020, the Prime Minister was having meetings, you know, with manufacturers, with the vaccine task force about, you know, making our indigenous vaccine, or even speaking to the foreign vaccine manufacturers, if need be, to, you know, to import the vaccine. So it's not that, you know, we woke up late and we didn't order. And, you know, that narrative was completely crushed because since April 2020, we've been talking to everybody. Okay. Now, we've been speaking to our own, so Serum Institute, Bharat Biotech, Zydus Cadila, you know, Genova. So we've been speaking to them and saying, do you need any money? If they need seed funding, if they showed proof of concept, you know, the government even gave them seed funding very, very quickly, you know. So ever since then, there was like a whole process that was going on. So obviously, we're still not a wealthy nation like the United States or the United Kingdom, you know. So we couldn't put in like billions and billions of, you know, dollars towards something that probably would not work, you know. So while this is the most risk funding that our government has done, it's still not what some of these wealthier nations did. So what that meant was that we were absolutely sure that once we had vaccines that work, we would then again fund them, augment their capacities so that the dosage would, you know, also come up. Now there, that's where the gap happened, right? So A, we knew that those proof of concept and that the vaccines work. Then the government funded them again by placing advance orders and giving them, you know, advance money from which they bought machinery, from which they bought raw material, and then augmented their, you know, manufacturing. So we knew that our vaccine supplies are going to be sort of like backloaded. So towards the end of 2021, we are going to see a lot of vaccines coming into the market and enough for almost our entire population. But the narrative that was set in the first four, five months of our vaccination drive, that we don't have vaccines, there's a vaccine shortage.
Yeah. And that we were exporting vaccines when, you know, we should stockpile them. Yeah.
Vaccine Maitri very, very important. We were able to get, you know, this was part of our diplomacy. We were able to get into markets that India never had access to, you know, from a security standpoint. It was a very, very important, it is a very, very important program. Yeah. So the whole narrative that there are not enough vaccines and, you know, you cannot export them and where are our vaccines and why isn't Pfizer here? Why isn't Moderna here? So even that narrative, right? Like Pfizer was asking for sovereign immunity waiver. That meant that they could, you know, supply vaccines to us anytime, even if they don't meet the timelines. We still have to accept the vaccines, even if they're late in the timelines, number one. Number two, for the payment, they wanted us to put, our sovereign properties up, you know, so which meant that if we defaulted on payments, they could, for instance, you know, they could go to one of our embassies and take away our computers, you know, say in New York. They could, you know, pick up one of our planes and go away, like, you know. So this is not okay for any country from a security standpoint. We were not okay to give that kind of sovereign immunity waiver. And what were the amount of vaccines they were willing to give us? 5 crore. There was a day where we inoculated administered 2 crore vaccines in a day.
Yeah.
They were willing to give us 5 crore vaccines in the entire year in 2021.
Right.
You know, so it just didn't make sense. And that too for like $15, $20, you know, that kind of price. What did we buy our vaccine at? We bought Covishield at 250 rupees. That's lower than the price that many of these countries were charging for ginger turmeric shots.
Right. One of the things you do really well in the book is also give some perspective and comparison on what's happening at that very moment across the world, right? Like, for example, you have the infection statistics and the death statistics at almost, I mean, 1 in 3 pages, you were made aware of that in comparison with these other countries, right? And there were many different comparisons, some of them really weird as well, like New Zealand being compared to India as if the population density could be at all compared, you know, in relative terms. In any case, I mean, when you compare with other countries, right? I mean, how did we do? How did we fare in comparison with those countries?
Yeah, so first of all, it is an unfair comparison to compare us to countries which are the size of like a semi-rural area of ours. So it's absolutely not fair to do that. Today, we are seeing, you know, we have proof. We're seeing the kind of saturation in vaccine coverage. Almost all of our adults are vaccinated with the first dose of the vaccine. And, you know, we're about to reach a 90% mark in the second dose. No other country that we know of that is transparent about its data has reached this kind of, you know, this kind of coverage and this kind of acceptance from what the government wants them to do. See, we've not mandated the vaccine. Despite not mandating these vaccines, people are going out to get, you know, by choice. So that is a win from a communications and from a trust in government standpoint. There was a lot being said about, you know, there's a lot of mocking going on about why is the Prime Minister's picture there on the vaccine search. You know, let me tell you that in rural areas, you know, there is so much superstition and rumor mongering that spreads so quickly that and especially fueled by some of these politicians, right, who say that this is not a credible vaccine and so on and so forth. The Prime Minister's picture on the vaccine certificate added that credibility that was needed to build trust in that, you know, but that, of course, mainstream media does not report. And it really helped increase vaccine uptake and, you know, trust in our response in those parts of the country where we could have seen a very high amount of hesitance.
And finally, moving on from COVID, right? I mean, what do you see as the impact on, let's say, things like geopolitics? You mentioned vaccine Maitri, right? On economy, we spoke about Atmanirbhar Bharat, on healthcare infrastructure. In general, you know, moving on from COVID, there is still a fourth wave that is predicted sometime in August, but I really hope and pray that it's less severe and really mild. But moving on from this episode, right? I mean, what are some things you expect?
So I think Atmanirbhar Bharat is really, you know, one of the finest things to come out of this crisis. We really have turned the crisis into an opportunity. Now, there are several people who believe that Atmanirbhar Bharat means a closed economy. That is not true. We are willing to plug ourselves into global supply chains. Okay, now let me give you an instance. Even though we have both vaccines that are made in India at this point, we still use many, many raw materials that we source from outside. Okay, so we get those raw materials from outside the country. We make the vaccines in the country, but we are also now planning to give out those vaccines to other nations, to other parts of the world that need affordable vaccines in large volumes, you know. So we are plugging ourselves. This is one example of how we have plugged ourselves in a position of strength in the global supply chain. Now, this is just vaccines. This can happen through, you know, entire product ranges. This is what we mean when we say Atmanirbhar, that we want to manufacture the products here. We want to send them out. We want to increase interaction in the global, you know, supply chains. We want to be a dependable partner for people who want to, you know, who are looking for products. And considering our stability, our political stability over here, considering the success and the stable economy that we're in, even when there is a complete stop, considering how quickly we rebound from that complete stop, considering all of this, you know, our demographics, you know, everything, considering all of this, it is a very real possibility that we provide a very, you know, we position ourselves and we are a very stable partner to a lot of countries for a lot of products. So we are not just the pharmacy of the world, you know, we are the go-to place for several products, and we should aim to, get more.
There were many stories of resilience, innovation, and one of the things that I have been really surprised by, in a very nice way, is the way people have come together, right? So do you recall some personal anecdotes or any examples, incidents of the last couple of years that kind of exemplify this?
So people coming together, see, that is the strength of India, right? Like, that's our culture. Like, we are so socially, built into each other's lives that even when there was such a strict lockdown, you would see Swiggy and, these Zomato drivers, risking their lives, to get food to the people. You would see policemen, so many of them have lost their lives in the line of duty, to enforce lockdown. You see bureaucrats like, Mr. Guru Prasad Mohapatra, he was heading the oxygen supply during the second wave of COVID. He got infected with COVID. He lost his life, to COVID, but he worked till the very end. So much so, he was so weak that in one of the meetings with the Prime Minister asked him, I'm surprised to see you here. Why are you in this meeting? So this is the kind of dedication that our, bureaucrats have shown, and they're just, they are so unnamed, they work behind the scenes to keep the country safe. So that's what has touched me the most.
So again, thank you so much for writing this book, Premji. I think it's a very, very important book. Everyone who's listening, you should definitely go out and get A Nation to Protect. We'll obviously link it in the podcast description and so on. Thank you again, Premji, for being on Bharat Varta.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. Likewise. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Bharat Varta podcast. If you want to see more content like this, then don't forget to subscribe to our channel. We started Bharat Varta to facilitate long-form discussions on politics, policy, and culture. We don't necessarily endorse anything that was said in this episode. If you wish to offer us feedback, do reach out to us on social media. We are at Bharat Varta on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You could also get in touch with us on our website, www.bharatvarta.in. The links are in the description below. Until next time, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.